Today's Teisho will be on Case 34 in the Book of Serenity. Case 34 is entitled Feng Shui's Single Atom. Introduction: Barehanded, empty-fisted, 1,000 changes, 10,000 transformations. Though this is making something out of nothing, what can you do? You employ the provisional to symbolize the real. But tell me, is there a fundamental basis or not? Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation perishes. If you don't set up a single atom, If you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. Zhuedu held up his staff and said, are there any mendicants who will die the same and live the same? Verse, as a graybeard rising from a hunt by the Wei River, how does that compare to those who starved in purity on Mount Shuyong? It just lies in a single atom, distinguishing changing conditions. Fame and accomplishment are both hard to efface. So this is the final day of our May 2022 Sesshin, and I'm very happy to say that we haven't lost anybody. Phil is online now, joining us. Yes, excellent. So I hope you, if you're feeling up to it, I hope you finish the Sesshin online. That would be wonderful. Okay, excellent. That was an ascent. Okay. I never thought of that. Well, of course, you could just go online. And you're thinking in two dimensions. That's excellent. All right. So good. So we haven't lost a person. Very good. How wonderful is that? So at any rate, this is the last day of our Sesshin. Everybody, of course, is sitting really deeply and coming into the Dokusan room and really opening their hearts up, you know. And I have to say, you know, I love poetry, I love hiking, I have to say that I just don't think there's anything else in the world like Zazen. Right, like Zazen, I think it's just so deeply transformative and so deeply liberating. I am a completely different person than I was when I started Zazen in 1977. And, you know, I've had a lot of pain in my legs and a lot of tired, you know, exhausted evenings, you know, making my way towards my bunk, you know, with my teeth chattering. But, it's like opening up vista after vista. Nothing else that I've encountered has quite that same extraordinary liberating quality. You know, I like literature. I'm an English teacher, and I like to read novels. And you know, when you read a novel, you're transported to another world. You know, and you might have a really big, big fat novel that it has 800 pages, and you spend a weeks reading this thing, and you become the characters. You know, their world becomes your world, and it's so liberating in its own way. But you know, you close the book, and you know, my experience is that your world has changed a little bit. You know, I'm not putting down literature. I love literature. But in a certain way, your world has changed a little bit. but not necessarily in a profound way, you know. And let me just say again, I really love literature, you know. I'll read a poem and, you know, I'll think about that poem for hours. And I've definitely learned things about how to live from reading literature. And literature has taught me like what to value and what not to value and how to value things. So I can remember the reading in high school Henry David Thoreau's Walden. And many of my classmates in American literature in the 11th grade hated Walden, right? They thought it was boring, and I thought it was fascinating, right? I just thought, this guy really lived, you know? It almost reads like a work of fiction, you know? This guy really lived, and it changed my life, right? I got into hiking. Subscribe to, you know, National Geographic, you know, that kind of thing. It's just like, oh my gosh, there's this natural world and we can be part of this. So yes, it definitely makes a difference, you know, in a big way. And I've read other novels that have really had this like a decisive impact on my life. I remember reading this wonderful book called Island by Aldous Huxley. If you ever get a chance, it's about a civilization that basically combines Western and Eastern mental cultivation, like Buddhism. Huxley was very interested in Zen and Vedanta and practiced meditation. And he was also like a scientist, or trained as a scientist. He worked as a novelist. But so yeah, reading Island really changed my mind about things. And there's lots of other books I could say this is sort of life transforming. But on the other hand, you know, there's a limitation to what these can do, because they are understood to be imaginary works of imagination, or art, you know. It's like art. I like to go to museums, and I like to spend a day at a museum. I have been doing that since I was a teenager. I used to live outside of Washington, D.C. for a while. My father was stationed near a naval facility in Washington. And I used to go in on a Saturday and spend the day at the Smithsonian and at the National Gallery of Art. And I would just wander looking at these paintings all day. And I love that, you know. And, you know, you look at these paintings and they show like the tragedy and the joy of life, or beauty, you know. And you something like, you know, men and women on the grass in a French park, you know, bathing in the water, you know, it's just like so different from the world I grew up in. And it made me realize it's a bigger world, you know. But, you know, we put these masterpieces in a museum and we go to see them and we call them art, and then we leave the museum and we go back to reality. And or you watch a movie like, I don't know if you saw Avatar, but I saw Avatar 5 times, right? And I'd be happy to see it again, you know. I couldn't believe it didn't win the Academy Award, because it was just I thought it was just this amazing movie. But you see Avatar, right? And all these people, millions of Americans went to see Avatar. It was a big success. And it's talking about how, you know, basically we've lost touch with the natural world. And it describes these people who have like deep communion with the natural world, right? If you didn't see the movie, if you were the only person in America who didn't see the movie, you know, they plug their pigtails into this root system, and the great Mother Tree connects them all, right? And it's totally cool, right? But, you know, people left that, and then they just went back to reality. It's a back to quote-unquote reality, right? And so, you know, they got in their cars, because that's how you get to the AMC, Cineplex. You know, and on the way home, they, you know, stopped at wherever and, you know, did their shopping and or whatever, you know, and they got home and they, you know, use their iPad and phone and so, you know. So in a way, you know, what we do is we say, okay, it's okay to be creative, but in the context of art, in the context of literature. So what we've done is we've separated like creativity from life, and we've made it a special thing. And what that means is that we live in ways that are very far from alive and creative. You know, we live in ways that are, you know, actually very, very narrow. And often not very alive. You know, if you thought of I remember reading a poet who was talking about the human being, and he said, you know, the human being has all these powers and abilities that never get used. And he said the human being is like an iPhone that's used as a doorstop. And I thought, man, that ain't it the truth. You know, that is so true. You know, and even our creativity is confined to special creative districts, special regions where we're allowed to be creative. So we say you can be creative in your art. But I think our everyday life is highly routinized. And I think our actual mental worlds, our experiential worlds, are highly constricted and routinized and controlled, you know. And very repetitive, you know. So if you think of consciousness not as one thing, but as like a spectrum, you know, there's a spectrum of consciousness. And at one end of the spectrum is that experience of intense, you know, unhappiness, misery, isolation, you know, anger, fear, greed, and so on, you know. The Buddhists call that samsara. And on the other end of this big spectrum is this connected, compassionate, generous, you know, selfless aliveness, right? That's nirvana. And between nirvana and samsara, there's all these different states of mind, you know. And I think we spend most of our lives in like one or two. It's like we in this vast continuum, this spectrum of consciousness, we spend our lives pretty much in just a couple of bandwidths, you know, a couple of narrow bandwidths. You know, so you know, we get up in the morning and we say, you know, we're in our bandwidth. We say, you know, I get up in the morning and I think, oh my God, you know, I've got to get to work. And, you know, I go down and have breakfast and I think, what would Kurt like for breakfast, you know? Kurt would like, you know, maybe I'll have, you know, chickpeas and rice. That's what I usually eat. So, but maybe I don't want that. You know, I actually have some gluten-free oatmeal. I don't know how they do that, but so maybe I'll have some gluten-free, you know. So what does Kurt want for breakfast, you know? And then what does Kurt want some coffee? I'll get Kurt some coffee, you know. And then I, you know, this is after meditating, right? And then if I don't have to teach, I'll work for a while and maybe go for a jog. But if I have to teach, I drive in and look for a parking place somewhere, get to my classes, meet my students, grade papers, etc. Then I come home, right? And that's my life. And when I'm at work, I'm planning my lessons, which I take a lot of pride in. And I have, you know, I have these familiar anxieties, right? I have my anxieties. By the time I get to the end of the day, you know, I go to bed, and then I get up, and it's almost the same thing again, right? It's just like, what does Kurt want for breakfast? You know, getting my classes ready, you know. Will my students like me? Will I be interesting? You know, will they laugh at my jokes? You know, and then I'm home, and then I think, oh no, you know, my sister-in-law, she's going crazy again. You know, and I worry about that. And then you lie in bed and you think, you know, what if they don't accept my article? What if they don't? You know, what if this happens? What if they raise the cost of, you know, beans or something? So, and then you go to bed, and then the next day it's the same thing, right? And we're all like driven from pillar to post, right? We're all just trying to make it, right? You know, so my sister-in-law, my wife's sister, you know, she's a retiree. She lives on a very narrow income, and you know, when the gas price goes way up, you know, that really hurts her, you know. So she's just trying to get by, you know, and most people are just trying to get by. We're just trying to do our jobs. We're just trying to be confident and capable. And we do want to be helpful, you know, but you know, the system just keeps us locked into these small mind routines, you know. And we very rarely have the chance to experience the vastness that underlies us all, right? And the thing that is so amazing about Zen is that it really is the project of Zen is to do just that. You know, it's the Zen starts with the assumption that the ordinary way of life is limited at best. And that it's based on a set of assumptions that are probably half wrong, half false. You know, so most people believe, for example, that, you know, life is a Darwinian struggle, you know, where the weak must be trampled and the strong must, you know, that kind of thing. You know, lots of values like that in our society. So Buddhism says, look, you know, this is not, you didn't come into this world for this, right? You know, the universe has labored for 14 billion years, you know, so we could lie awake at night and be afraid of the price of gas. You know, that's a tragedy, right? Now, and I worry about the price of gas too. But if we let that be our life, that's a tragedy. So, you know, Zen is about saying, look, there's a big world out there, and there's a big world in here, and they're connected. And if we start tinkering, lift the hood up and start tinkering under the hood, we realize, you know, there's all these powers and abilities and experiences that are normally closed off to us that we can experience. And that if we do this, the world is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the Buddhist view is more and more loving and connected and awake, right? So you know, our method is not to trust ordinary mind, not ordinary mind of the koan, but not to trust the conventional consciousness that people call reality. You know, the conventional consciousness that people call reality is not real. It's a collective construction that has many false elements. You know, I'm sure you've seen that wonderful commercial. There's a commercial. The fact that it's a commercial is sad in itself, but it's selling something. But it's about that famous World War I scene where it's like Christmas Eve and either the Germans or the English start singing carols, and the other side hears them singing carols and joins in.
Right.
And then they realize, you know, they're both observing this holiday. They both have, you know, they both have the same religion and the same values. And they come up out of the trenches and they walk across no man's land and shake each other's hand. And you know, at such moments, people realize, you know, that the world we live in is not real. It's a often really destructive fantasy, collective fantasy, shared fantasy. You know, the sad thing is after this Christmas, they go back to shooting each other, right? And that's sort of like going to a museum, right? Even though I love going to a museum, it's like the experience of openness and wonder is in the museum, it's in the library. But you know, it and maybe it's in the national park, right? So I love to go to a park and spend a week or two hiking. You know, that then I feel like I'm in another world. It's open, beautiful. Then it's not that life here isn't good in many ways, but you know, it has this restrictive quality. So Zen is about not accepting that. It's not, you know, it starts with the assumption, the sutras say that the world people live in is upside down. It's upside, the values are incorrect, you know. So what we're practicing here on the koan, on the sashin, is, you know, we're gradually liberating ourselves from our psychological ruts. And we're learning how to be more exploratory about that spectrum. And you know, when you begin to explore the spectrum, you find some strange things, you know. So it's definitely the case that when you're dealing with some koans, you know, you may discover, you know, hell, what are called hell realms, you know, realms of unhappiness in yourself that you didn't want to confront. But you will also discover, you know, one of the seven deva heavens, these beautiful states, you know, of consciousness. And, you know, you go to this hell realm, and you go to this heaven realm, and you go to this hell realm, and this heaven realm. You begin to realize, you know, that there's a real possibility, you know, that the consciousness isn't fixed. It's not, there's no such thing as reality. There's realities. And we can be creative about how we live. We can be compassionate in ways that we didn't even know possible.
Right.
You know, everybody's talking these days about, you know, mindfulness meditation, which is a wonderful thing. But, you know, a lot of mindfulness meditation says, you know, we're fighting with the monkey mind. And what we want to do is be in the moment. Just be in the moment. And a lot of the literature about meditation, especially for beginners, says, you know, the books have titles like The Work of This Moment. Or just be in the moment. In the Eckhart Tolle book that has made $40 million, you know, is called The Power of Now.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, many people get involved in meditation because of Eckhart Tolle. You know, so good for him, you know. But the thing is, actually, being in the moment is not a solution. It's a problem. It's not the solution, it's a problem. Because there isn't really one moment. You know, so being in the moment is actually a problem. It's a question or a koan. You know, because there isn't one moment. There's not such a thing as this moment, actually. Even though we say that, you know. There's many different moments we can experience this now in many different ways. as a hell realm, as a heaven realm, you know. And so there isn't really like a moment that is a fixed character or that is absolutely objective for all people. You know, how we experience our existence is up to us. It's something we have to be creative about or artistic about. And so, you know, we create the moment we inhabit to a degree we don't even understand. But we create this moment, and we can create it skillfully or unskillfully. And when we create it skillfully, we feel connected and loving and open. And when we are unskillful about it, you know, we feel angry or resentful or grouchy, whatever. So you know, there isn't really one objective world, actually. You know, when we sit down on the cushion, you know, we start with the common, with the world of, like we say, the ordinary consciousness. So that has several layers. The top layer of the mind is the mind that thinks in, you know, sentences, and it's maybe saying, when I go to work on Tuesday, you know, I have to get that report done, or I have to get this from my boss, or, oh brother, you know, I have to deal with that teenager again, you know, that kind of thing. And then underneath that, there's like this river of thoughts, this river of fragments of thoughts, just like this stream of consciousness, right? And under that, you know, is that just on the edge of the unconscious, where the conscious and the unconscious meet, you know, things come floating up to the surface, right? So you might be sitting on the cushion. I remember going to a sesshin long ago, and this guy named Gordon. His name was Gordon Goodykoontz. Gordon Goodykoontz. And his father was actually like a famous Protestant theologian. And he had gotten into Zen. He was studying Zen with Genki Roshi. And he was making all this progress at first. He was sitting very still. And then he came to this sesshin and he said, you know, I can't get out of my mind this music. You know, I leave thoughts behind, my mind becomes still and calm, and then I hear this music, and it's, I can't get it out of my mind. And it was so frustrating to him. It was the introductory jingle for a commercial, you know. It's like, I'd like to buy the world a Coke. It wasn't that, but it was like that. And he just couldn't shake it, and it's like, what? You know, the thing is, as you go down below the level, you leave the thinking mind, you go below the level of fragments of thought, and then you get down into this area that's a little gray, and things start coming up. And, you know, maybe music or something. It's like you have all these stored tape loops in there, right? And maybe memories come up. And all of this is arising on the cushion sometimes, right? And there's no one way to combine all this. There's no one right way to combine all this. You know, but you know, as we go down through the layers of the mind, you know, we begin to realize that a lot of our behavior is conditioned responses, based on past experiences. So, you know, how we greet the moment is never neutral and objective. You know, when we enter this moment, or when we're present here and now, all of these unacknowledged tape loops are playing in our head. And when we meditate, you know, we gradually discover them, especially if we're working with koans. You know, things come to the surface that, you know, old injuries or memories you've forgotten for 20 years, you know, they come to the surface and, you know, they re-trigger old anxieties or sorrows. But, you know, actually, eventually they just sort of like unwind. they stop triggering these responses. And you see them, but they are no longer producing responses. And when you return to the moment, you know, it's a different moment. You know, often it's like, it feels like having the chains taken off, you know? So, you know, I can remember coming to many sesshins where I was barely present in the world, right? My anxieties would be so powerful that, you know, it was hard for me to just focus on a task. You know, I'd be getting ready for a graduate class. And I remember I took this philosophy of literature class and we were reading, sorry, allergies. We were reading Heidegger and Poetically Man Dwells is what it was called. And it was just like, it was just overwhelming. I just found it so difficult. And, you know, I would do things like, you know, this was back in the days when there weren't automatic, you know, coffee pots. I'd take the coffee off the burner and I'd make coffee and then I would leave the burner on, right? And my wife would come in and, my God, you're going to burn the place down. You know, it was like, what place? Yeah. So it's so overwhelmed by all of these loops, right? And you come to sesshin and you sit down on the cushion and you gradually uncover all of this stuff. You see your anxiety, you see your fear, and you see through your fear, you know. And it gradually, you see the sources of your fear, and it goes away. Gradually, it stops triggering. It's like, okay, I don't understand Heidegger, that's okay. I'm like the other, you know, 7.2 billion people on Earth, right? Maybe somebody who knows this will explain it to me. You know, so it's not really about not knowing Heidegger. It's really about being a 7-year-old. I was the kid in baseball who always, you know, the pop fly is coming down at me, and every kid on the team knows I'm going to drop the ball, right? And it's like, oh, we don't want you on the team ever again, right? You know, that kind of thing. So that's a lot of my fear of Heidegger, right? Here comes the Heidegger, and I'm going to drop the ball, and everybody's not going to want me on the team. So, you know, you work through this stuff, and when you come back, it's a different moment. It's really a different moment. It's a different place. So it's not like there's a moment there that we have to adjust to. It's that, you know, we create the moment we live in. And it seems to me that Buddhism is about taking responsibility for our ability to, taking responsibility for doing that, for living a creative life, you know. One person looks at a forest and says, this is a sacred grove and nothing should ever impinge on it, right? That would be me. So I can remember the first time I was hiking in Olympic National Park, and I just thought, you know, I felt like I was in the presence of God. You know, it's like, this is so majestic. This is such a great mystery. You know, and there are people who look at that and think, you know, that's a billion board feet of lumber, you know. And somebody else looked at that and thinks, this is a crime. You know, we need a motel right here, you know. So, you know, what's the right answer, right? You could do any A, B, or C, but you know, which one do you want to do, right? And Buddhism is about saying, you know, it's your choice. Choices have consequences. You know, if you cut down all the trees, you get flooding, you get all these dire consequences. But, you know, there's a consequence also if you don't cut it down, you know. So there's really no one right answer for how we live. But you know, if you practice the art of Zazen, the art of the great way, you know, what you're really doing is saying, I want to live fearlessly, and I want to put compassion at the center of my life. And, you know, when you do those things, the world you get is like a really wonderful place. It's a really, it's not a hell realm, it's at the other end of the spectrum. And so I think there's just nothing like, there's nothing like Zazen. It's like being creative with your consciousness. It's like we're artists of consciousness. You know, we realize that there's no one right way to live. We can be selfish. You know, we can shoot at the Germans across no man's land. We can be brutal, and, you know, those are all allowed by our existence. They have consequences, right, for us and for other people. Or we can, you know, cultivate the Buddha's way and become bodhisattvas, you know. And that has consequences for us too and for other people. Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. See? So one way to read this koan is to say, single atom is like this moment, this moment. So one way to understand this is Feng Shui saying, if you are so obsessed with the future or the past that you can't be in the moment, that's a bad thing. And, you know, the nation perishes, right? So if we don't take care of the here and now, the nation perishes, okay? So that seems like a pretty clear statement. He's saying, be mindful of this moment, the single atom, right? That sounds like, you know, mindfulness of moment. But, you know, the koan has a hook, right? The koan has a hook. You know, when you begin to look for the moment, you can't find it. In the Diamond Sutra, it says, there is no past mind, there is no present mind, and there is no future mind. Those all are just imaginary constructions. You know, so the first part of the koan is saying, please be in the moment. And you say, okay, let me be in the moment. But actually, there's no one way to be in the moment. And in fact, there's no one moment. You know, we create the moment. We create the moment we inhabit. And that's really the second part of this koan. So Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. So just be in the moment. Zhuido held up his staff and said, are there any mendicants who will die the same and live the same? So actually, he's saying, do we live in the same moment? Do we live in the same moment? And, you know, that's a question or a koan that this koan wants us to ask about. And one way to answer it is to say, well, we can live in the same moment. We don't necessarily live in the same moment, but we can live in the same moment if we want to, right? And we can live in the same moment happily or unhappily, and wisely or unwisely. You know, it's up to us. It's up to us. So the world can be like paradise, natural paradise, like Avatar, or it can be like a hell realm. It's as individuals, we only have so much power, but if we transform this moment into a paradise, you know, that's a beginning. That's what we can do, right? If we transform this moment into a Buddhist paradise, you know, that's a start of a 9 billion people doing the same thing is going to make a very nice world. And even if they are busily destroying it, it's still better for us and for the world if we do make this moment a Buddha's paradise. You know, that's our duty, and it's also our joy, right? Because doing that, whether the world goes up in flames or not, doing that is an act, is expression of trust and love, right? And what better way to live? So the second part of this koan is saying, look, you know, you create the world. You create the world. We all create the world together, but you create the moment you inhabit. And what's so wonderful about this sesshin is that everybody has done such a beautiful job of creating, you know, in Buddhist scripture, they talk about the pure land. The pure land, there's pure land Buddhism, and people don't know what that means. But it actually means, and people think sometimes of pure land Buddhism as being kind of superstitious. But that's very incorrect. You know, the teaching of the pure land is that we have to create a Buddha's paradise here on earth in this moment. And the way to do it is to purify body, mind, and heart, just as we've done at this sesshin. And now that we know that consciousness is not fixed, but that there's the potential for enlightenment and for, like, samsara, you know, we have come a long way. So in the remaining hours of our time together, please create the pure land in your moment. And it's a moment we can all share, and we're all lucky enough to be able to share it until 6 o'clock tonight. So please keep up the good work.